From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Despite the focus here on embeds and video phones, the big media story out of Iraq centers on Al Jazeera, the news channel based in Qatar that is not only the most cited news source in the region, but increasingly around the world. Here's one measure of its popularity. The search engine Lycos reported that Al Jazeera was the top search term last week, with three times more searches than sex.
But Al Jazeera is also hugely unpopular with people like Donald Rumsfeld, who objected to grisly pictures of American POWs broadcast by the channel, and Iraqi officials who don't like Al Jazeera's aggressive reporting tactics. In fact, this week, the Iraqi government booted one of Al Jazeera's reporters from Baghdad, prompting the channel to suspend much of its coverage in Iraq. This setback follows Al Jazeera's recent ejection from the New York Stock Exchange and hacker attacks on its English-language website. Joanne Tucker is managing editor of the English-language website. She's on the line from Doha, Qatar. Joanne, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Has Al Jazeera gotten an official explanation about why its reporters were kicked out of the country or asked not to report?
The reasons given for this directive from the Iraqi Information Ministry was that they did not like Taysir Alouni, who is our reporter and who is our exclusive reporter in Afghanistan. They did not like his reports from Najaf in the south.
What were their objections?
They specifically did not like his reports where he made the claim that Iraqi forces were shielding themselves behind holy sites. They did not appreciate any negative criticism in his report.
Now, this isn't the first time that Al Jazeera has run afoul of authoritarian regimes in the Arab world. But it's puzzling because with its heavy focus on civilian casualties in this war, it seemed like the Iraqi regime's campaign for hearts and minds of its own people was benefiting from Al Jazeera's presence. Were you surprised that this one isolated report would result in these sanctions?
We didn't expect it, but we're not entirely surprised. This expulsion, I think, reflects negatively on the government, not on us. We have nothing to lose. If they lose our voice from Najaf or anywhere else, or even another voice from Baghdad, I think they lose out more than we do.
Let's talk about your project, the English language website. You launched it early last week, but within 24 hours, the site was hit by hackers. And since then, it's been virtually impossible for those on the internet to view your site. Do you know what happened?
We do know what happened. Within 10 to 12 hours of going live online, our servers, one in the United States and one in Europe, were bombarded with legitimate server requests that basically flooded the DNS server and blocked access to the site. Following that, within a couple of days, 2 to 3 days, somebody got hold of our domain name. The very fact that these hacking attacks are so huge and so directed at our server actually completely undermines the whole idea of democracy and freedom. What kind of liberation of minds and, you know, people is it if a country or hacking attacks originating in that country can't take a different point of view?
From your answer, I suggest that you don't entirely dismiss the rumors that have been flying around the internet that this was somehow actually a CIA job, that the U.S. government itself went in to hack the site. Of course, the other possibility is that some bored teenager someplace in the suburbs did it. What are your suspicions?
We doubt very much it's a bored teenager from the suburbs, simply because the amount of bandwidth being used to hack our site, be it Arabic or English, on a daily, hourly basis has been very extensive. I'm not saying it's a government job, but it's very professional. And it's also backed up by the fact that a few days ago we found another U.S.-based company that basically wrote us a letter on the 28th of March saying they were delighted to take our site over and they were going to deliver the site to thousands of local servers worldwide so that it would be far harder to hack us. 3 days later, that very same company withdrew and just terminated the contract, point blank. There is a huge amount of political pressure being applied somewhere on these companies.
Had the website not been hacked, would we have been seeing those controversial images of the dead American soldiers and the prisoners of war being paraded for public view?
The actual story that we ran on the English website showed a picture of one dead U.S. serviceman on the ground and showed two of the U.S. POWs. We reported it, I thought, in a very straight, down-the-middle kind of way.
But is it also possible that, considering the perceived sympathies towards the Arab point of view, that these images, as aired on Al Jazeera, were viewed as a sort of gloating?
They were not gloating. Without doubt, the pictures of the dead on the ground were uncomfortable to watch. But I keep bringing up the point, how many, now hundreds, of Iraqi civilians have been killed with very, very, very disgusting images, images that we have broadcast. And, of course, it would break the heart of any American person who probably knew those soldiers to see those pictures. I do not at all say that those pictures of the dead should have been aired. But the POW pictures were not humiliating in any shape or form. You know, it would have given me hope if I was any way connected to these Americans to see them alive, to see them well, and to see them a little bit afraid, but to see them okay.
Allow me to share with you the headlines from your website shortly before it was hacked. The first is Iraq hit by a new wave of attacks. The second, Basra on the verge of humanitarian crisis. The third, U.S. precision bomb destroys civilian bus. Speaking for myself personally, and I happen to be ambivalent about this war, I seethe when I look at the Al Jazeera site for the very reason that its raison d'etre is to be a revolutionarily objective source for news about the Arab world. It strikes me that, especially in wartime, Al Jazeera has a special responsibility to play it straight down the middle and not to reflect back the worldview of its audience.
But we're not just looking at ourselves and reflecting what we see in the mirror. Yes, we do take the temperature of the region and take what they say far more seriously and far more into account than, you know, your Western TV does. Does this mean we skew the news? I don't think you can say that. If you honestly and intelligently reflect the opinions and the facts and the views of this part of the world, how can it be skewing the news any more than reflecting the West's views and opinions skews the news for Western watchers? Can a person be 100% objective? I don't think so. I haven't seen it. I keep hearing about this holy grail of objectivity and neutrality. I certainly don't see it on American television. So, you know, how they can apply these standards to us all the time, I don't know. But we try and report as honestly and, as you say, as revolutionarily, meaning probing taboos, crossing red lines as often as we can. Does this get us in hot water all the time? But I think this is a price worth paying.
Well, Joanne, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Bob.
Joanne Tucker is the managing editor of Al Jazeera's new English language website, which is back online after a major hacker attack. She joined us from her office in Doha, Qatar.
Last weekend, TV Guide magazine conducted a survey of TV viewers to find out who was watching what for news of the war. TV Guide's Max Robbins is on the line with the results. Max, welcome back to the show.
Brooke, great to be here.
So who is the most trusted anchor on the air?
Well, according to our poll, it was NBC's Tom Brokaw. He had 22%. He was followed by Peter Jennings with 17%, then Dan Rather with 16%, and also Fox's Shepard Smith with 16%.
And how did CNN's Aaron Brown do?
Aaron Brown kind of trailed the pack with 11%.
It's a little surprising that Fox's Shepard Smith scored so high.
Well, what's even more surprising, Brooke, is when you break out the 18 to 24-year-old demographic, Shepard Smith topped our list. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that the way people watch TV, a lot of times their biases go with people who look the most like them, and certainly Shepard Smith is a lot younger than the other people who were in the poll.
I think it's fair to say it's been a good war for Fox. I think a lot of us expected CNN to wipe the floor with its arch rival, but I guess that really hasn't happened, or not altogether.
What we found in our poll is that when people hear that there's big news breaking, they turn to CNN first. They go there first, but they don't stay. They'll surf onto Fox or elsewhere.
What is specifically the appeal of Fox? I know that any casual viewer will see that it is very, very pro-war, pro-administration in its coverage. Is that the big draw, do you think?
I think that has a lot to do with it. Fox went into this war very strong as the number one cable news network. They've been very pro-war, pro-Bush administration. And the vast majority of Americans right now are supporting the war in Iraq. And I think that that's paid off in terms of ratings.
I guess it's reassuring to people. I noticed that in your study, though most people said that the TV coverage hadn't affected their support or lack of support for the war, still a surprising percent, about a quarter, said that the TV coverage did increase their support for the war.
Yeah, 25% said that after watching the coverage of the war, they were more supportive of the war effort. And it is a striking number, especially when you look at the time frame when our poll was taken. It was taken when things weren't going particularly well last weekend.
And all around, I guess, a majority of viewers found the TV coverage to be satisfactory or more than satisfactory?
Yeah, we found three-quarters of the audience thought that the coverage ranged from good to very good to excellent. I mean, that's a real thumbs up for the job that television news overall is doing.
And as you say, that was after a week of rather bleak war news. I wonder whether people will become more dissatisfied with the coverage as the war continues.
You have to ask yourself, Brooke, if things get a lot rougher than they've been so far, if the viewing public won't start blaming the messenger.
Well, Max, thanks a lot.
Brooke, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Max Robbins writes The Robbins Report for TV Guide.
Next up, a look under the cushions of TV's armchair generals and a best-selling book series, Fervent Take on the War.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The dangers to so-called unilateral reporters, those not embedded with the military, are well acknowledged. At least three are dead, several others are missing and presumed dead, still more are wounded. But embedded reporters have regarded themselves as somewhat better protected, tucked within coalition forces. On Friday, however, the first embedded reporter, The Atlantic Monthly's Michael Kelly, was killed in a Humvee accident in Iraq. Every week for the last five, we've checked in with NPR's John Burnett, embedded with a Marine Command battalion. But as reporters there were increasingly closed off from information, he looked for an assignment closer to the action. Recently, he managed to obtain a slot with an artillery unit quickly moving just behind the front line. When we spoke to him on Thursday, he was 20 miles from Baghdad and moving fast.
This is kind of the catbird seat. This is a pretty good place to be. We saw some amazing things beside the road, a town where there'd been a big battle, and fires and smoldering tanks and, you know, all the things that you expect to see in a battlefield, which I'm finally seeing, which I never saw when I was with the headquarters battalion. Once you get away from this kind of constipated attitude that everybody has in the command headquarters, everything kind of loosens up. And so people, you know, they're junior officers, they're lieutenants, and they're sergeants, and they're all happy to talk about what's going on. I mean, within a few hours of leaving the command headquarters, I'm not going to say who, but they showed me a map of the entire battlefield, and they showed me all the blue pieces, which were the American troops, and all the red pieces, which were the Iraqis. And this is the stuff that I've been wanting to see for weeks now. You know, what the hell is happening on the battlefield?
I can imagine, though, that even sitting among the troops right behind the front line of the battle, you're probably wondering what's going on the other side.
One of the unnatural things about the embedding process is we don't get a sense of how Iraqis are reacting to this really enormous invasion, you know, all the highways north completely full bumper to bumper with U.S. military vehicles. And I, you know, I see them on the streets, and I just wish I could get a translator and jump down there. This is what I usually do when I cover a war zone, is to kind of mix with the local population. And we can't jump back and forth and talk to town folk and cover the military at the same time. It's either or. And as far as I know, there's only one reporter who's able to do that, Dexter Filkins with the New York Times. He's a lone wolf. He's a unilateral. He's traveling with one of the fighting regiments. He has been able to unofficially embed himself, and he's stopping and talking to Iraqis, you know, how people in the towns are reacting to the Americans. He's getting great stuff, and I'm envious.
One advantage, at least, of being embedded is that you feel safer than you would wandering on your own out in the field. Do you think at this point that if you could, you'd give it up to go out and see how the other side of the battle line is taking this?
No. Actually, it's the exact opposite, Brooke. We are getting very close to Baghdad. 20 minutes before I called you, we had a gas alert. We all had to go to a level called MOP 4, which means completely encasing ourselves in protective gear and a mask. And there was a very real hit on one of the chemical biological monitors here. And we were very aware that you know, the closer that U.S. troops get to Baghdad, the higher the possibility is that they will get hit with chemical weapons. And so I really want to be around security specialists, if you will, at this point.
We have talked earlier about the risk of embedding, not just to your life and limb, but also the risk of over-identifying with troops and this sort of American bubble view of the war. What do you think that a reporter in your situation can give the American people that they couldn't otherwise get from a unilateral, say?
In the first place, understand that there are very, very few unilateral reporters who have done as well as Dexter Filkins within the New York Times. There are very few up here. I mean, just a bare handful. Most of the information that people are getting are from the embedded reporters. And again, it's a bit of a distorted relationship. Yet, more than anything else, I think it reflects what happened in World War II in Vietnam, where you just had journalists who lived with the troops and told their story as they went into combat and came into harm's way. So it's a bit stranger with all the rules, but essentially we're doing what war correspondents have always done, I think.
John, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Brooke.
NPR's John Burnett is with an artillery unit. When we spoke to him Thursday, he was headed to Baghdad.
All of a sudden, there are a lot of generals on TV. A lot of generals being very specific.
We need to let the Air Force work over the Republican Guards, if they can. There's no indication.
The Iraqis are terribly worried about an American thrust, not only from the south, not only from the southeast, but also from the west, and it makes it very
I think for certain that by now Saddam has got to understand that with the amount of forces that we have in the region, with those that he now has picked up from the media that are en route, that his days are definitely numbered.
In past conflicts, the generals ran the war, the press did the analysis, and the retired military played gin rummy in varying degrees of frustration and satisfaction about what was transpiring on the battlefield. For the past few military adventures, however, television has increasingly turned to the pool of ex-warriors for expert analysis of the action on the land, on the sea, and in the air. For the current war in Iraq, 24 so-called armchair generals have maintained a ubiquitous on-air presence. The question is brass-plated TV helping or hurting our understanding of what's actually going on?
It's a lot like watching a Dallas Cowboys broadcast where all the commentators are former Dallas Cowboys or even current Dallas Cowboys.
Chris Sullentrop writes for Slate.com.
They're analyzing, but they're not criticizing. I think every general that's on the air has a dual loyalty. They're aware that foreigners, including people in the Middle East, watch CNN, and because of that, they know that they're representatives of the Pentagon. So they tend to gush on and on about how wonderful it's going, and luckily it is going wonderfully. But you'll notice the civilian analysts are much more critical than the generals.
In the first week of the war, for example, when supply lines for the coalition's northern push toward Baghdad seemed alarmingly long and thin, the print press was filled with hand-wringing about war planning that underestimated the threat of Iraq's forces in the south. Those worries were echoed by embedded reporters and anchors on cable and broadcast news programs, but the ex-brass expressed little concern and a lot of confidence in their former comrades in arms.
I think overall it is progressing in an orderly fashion. I believe that we've probably encountered a little more resistance in places along the way than was probably envisioned early on. But I note that General Franks is quickly adjusting his plan, and I anticipate that this will continue to go very well.
One ex-officer disgusted with the on-air retirees is Colonel David Hackworth, the maverick Vietnam officer turned maverick military affairs journalist. He believes that most armchair generals are simply mouthing the Pentagon line, not necessarily because they're too loyal to the Pentagon, but perhaps too deferential to their current paymasters.
It's become a major industry, Bob, meaning each time they do a thing on TV, the cash register goes ka-ching. I have a little problem with critics that sound off that are on the payroll, because I don't see how they can be objective and true to themselves.
Appearing himself before the war on CNBC's Kudlow and Kramer program, Hackworth says he found his arguments against rushing into armed conflict to be unwelcome.
I said, well, it's easy for you chicken hawks to have this attitude. You've never served on the battlefield. You don't really know what you're talking about, but you're spouting the party line that's coming out of Washington, D.C. Well, Bob, I was never invited back.
Two other retired warriors who have had no reluctance to speak their minds are NBC's Barry McCaffrey, the former White House anti-drug czar and Army four-star, and ex-Army Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters on CNN. Their outspokenness on the deficiencies of the war effort got under the skin of Joint Chiefs Chairman General Richard Myers.
So there may be others that have other ideas of how we should have done it. And God bless them. That's a great sport here inside the Beltway. And I suppose when I retire, I'll probably have my comments too. Gee, they ought to have more air power.
Of course, another possibility is that the TV generals are motivated neither by undue allegiance to their ex-comrades or to their new media bosses. They may just be good analysts, seeing the big picture behind the high-profile but transitory messes of the day. Jeff Schneider is a vice president and spokesman for ABC News.
I think that they're a little more immune to the, peaks and troughs of this story than perhaps a lot of other people are, and maybe they see the big picture. I don't think it's a function of their desire to support and protect the people that they used to work with.
Fair enough, but getting back to the question of whether viewer enlightenment is being served, endless reiterations of big-picture optimism at some point cease to be analysis and start becoming cheerleading. And if, in the midst of the transitory but bloody messes of the day, that's all the armchair generals have to offer, perhaps the networks should more often train their cameras elsewhere. Let the journalists focus on the news, and off-camera, somewhere in the green room, let the gin rummy games begin.
And now for some of your letters. In response to our story about naming military operations, Irving Kagan from New York City wrote, "You might have mentioned the mission to Panama. The Bush administration christened it Operation Just Cause. I always thought it would have been better to call it Operation Just Cause."
And we learned that William Whitworth, editor emeritus of the Atlantic Monthly, is watching the Fox TV program 24 as closely as we are. He wrote, "During your recent discussion of the similarities between current reality and the TV show 24, you neglected to point out an important dissimilarity. On the show, the president is hesitant about going to war, while the military seems eager to go. In reality, the enthusiasts for going to war were the president and various civilian advisors." Whitworth sums up with, "In the contemporary world, the notion of a warmongering American military is a Hollywood fantasy."
And before we wrap this up, we have to put a certain issue to rest. Many of you have written to correct our correction. Bob referred to O negative blood in a piece as the universal donor, and I selected a letter correcting him. Now I stand corrected once and for all. An O negative donor is a universal donor.
As I said, editors, we don't want your blood, just your letters. Send them to onthemedia.org, and don't forget to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name.
On April 8th, the 11th installment in the best-selling series of Left Behind novels by evangelist Tim LaHaye and writer Jerry Jenkins will appear in stores. It's expected to debut as number one on bestseller lists, as have each of the last four Left Behind books. So far, the series has been read by an estimated 40 million people. The entire series is actually one story, tracing the experiences of characters who are left behind when God takes committed Christians into heaven to spare them the ordeals that culminate in Armageddon. Fundamentalist Christians have long had an interest in the Middle East. Now, while war rages in what was once Babylon, many believe the end time is near. Melanie McAllister teaches at George Washington University. Recently, she wrote in the Washington Post about the potential ramifications of the Left Behind series. Professor McAllister, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me what this latest and very timely installment of Left Behind is all about.
Well, the new book is called Armageddon, and Armageddon is, as we all know, the great battle at the end of time. In the writer's interpretation, it's a battle between Israel and her allies and the rest of the world, led by the Antichrist, who has his capital in New Babylon, Iraq.
So this is a kind of classic comic book version of what is actually going on in the Middle East right now.
It's been the contention of a lot of this strain of fundamentalist Christian thinkers that events in the Middle East are the signal that God gives them that the end of times is happening. And that, in fact, LaHaye has said over and over again that the founding of Israel in 47 and the taking over of Jerusalem in 67 were, in fact, what he calls the super sign of the coming of the end of times. And then the rest of the events which are supposed to unfold in Iraq and Israel are more indications that God is about to act in history. So these books speak very much to contemporary Middle East politics and quite consciously.
I think it's fair to say that the Left Behind series is astonishingly popular and sort of goes under the radar of much of the media. Are there any precedents?
Hal Lindsey's book, The Late Great Planet Earth, was a nonfiction exposition of the interpretation that LaHaye and others also subscribe to. And that book was the best-selling nonfiction book of the entire decade of the 1970s. There's also a whole industry of videos. Pat Robertson has written a novel. There's really a prophecy industry that until now has been mostly popular amongst evangelicals. But every indication is that the Left Behind series has a much larger audience than that.
Let's talk about the political vision of the Left Behind series. There's a quote from your article. You say, "LaHaye and Jenkins join a chorus of fundamentalist commentators who, despite their protestations to the contrary, have expressed a perverse enthusiasm for the spilled blood and millions of dead that will signal the second coming." Now, that's a bit hard, don't you think?
Well, actually, I don't think it is. And in fact, I'm not the only person to say this. A lot of Protestant theologians who aren't evangelicals have bemoaned what they see as a real kind of enthusiasm for the horrors that are to come, which are very vivid in the books. I mean, the books are exciting when the demon locusts come in and start biting everybody and making them suffer for 5 months, and all but the Christians are going to go through terrible torment. Nothing can relieve them, but it's all happening in the context of something quite exciting, and it is all evidence of God's action.
You said that Europe's literature of the horrors of war has fostered pacifism and wariness of war there. So these novels must be influencing the American view of war today. I presume by that you mean not just those who are already converted, but those that may not be.
The authors and the publisher say that about half of the readers are not Christian, by which I think they mean not evangelical Christian. And for those folks in particular, the novels might provide a sense that war is, though horrific, maybe not so much to be decried because of the way it fits into this larger plan. Now, I should be clear here that not all evangelicals subscribe to this kind of prophecy interpretation, and certainly not to this particular strain, but there is a large number of people who do believe that the kind of wars that will come at the end of time are something to be looked at with both horror and a kind of anticipation in the sense that they lead to something else.
How many people do you think that is, roughly?
Well, we know that from recent polls that about 40% of all Christians are evangelicals. And since most Americans are Christian, about 80%, that means that about 32% of Americans are evangelical Christian. But even more interesting, the recent Time poll found that 59% of Americans said they believed that the events predicted in Revelation will come true. That is, they believe that some version of a prophecy of the end of times is actually going to happen. That's 59%. So how many of them actually think that this war is the war that's going to prepare the way for Armageddon? It's hard to know, but I do know that the Left Behind books would encourage that view, and that the Left Behind website and other places actually explicitly talk about the real possibility that this war is one of the events to lead up to the second coming of Christ.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Melanie McAllister is an associate professor of American Studies at George Washington University and author of Epic Encounters, Culture, Media, and U.S. Interests in the Middle East, 1945 to 2000.
Coming up, what Iraqi teenagers really think and how American GIs won the heart of a former member of the Hitler Youth.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Writing last week in The Washington Post, author Paul Berman noted that Iraqi exiles who liken the Iraqi regime to that of Nazi Germany may not be so far off base. European totalitarian movements of the last century do share some fundamental traits with that of Saddam's: paranoid ideologies, a total police state, a taste for murder. Denazification was accomplished through the actions of many government and non-governmental agencies after the war, but the first action, of course, was undertaken by American GIs.
Ottmar Rudolph is an emeritus professor of German and the humanities at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. That's today. He was born in 1929 and raised in Nazi Germany. For his first 15 years, everything he knew was filtered through the lens of Nazi ideology. The analogy is far from perfect, but we thought he could shed some light on the challenge America is confronting now. Professor Rudolph, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
So when did you first begin to come under the influence of Nazism?
When I went to school, I would say basically about when I was 10 years old. The war was then going well. It was 1939, 40, and the victories were left and right. And that, of course, was elating to us young boys.
You were in the Hitler Youth?
Yes. All of us, it was mandatory to go into the service of the Hitler Youth. And we, as young boys, enjoyed it. We liked it. If I wouldn't have my family, this could have easily been the route towards a SS soldier. I came home one day with a picture of Adolf Hitler, and I wanted to put it on my wall. My father was irate and took it right down. My mother said, listen, this is our Führer. Why don't you let him do it? This is the first time I saw and heard my father and my mother argue in a way which you can't understand. I could have easily turned him in, and he would have been sent to a camp or at least to a prison if I would have turned it in, as many young people did.
But it never occurred to you to do that.
No. I think my bonds to my father and especially to my mother were much greater.
Given the intense bombing that was going on, it's not hard to imagine the German attitude towards the Allies.
Yes, my home city was destroyed, 68%, 69%. There were terror bombings, which we call terrorists. I even wrote an essay for my school class in German titled, We Shall Pay Them Back, These War Gangsters.
What was your first encounter with the Allies like?
My first seeing of an Allied soldier was American. And we saw the American GI coming in and their jeeps with their uniforms, which were, we considered, no uniforms. How could they have such a uniform? Look at the German uniforms. What kind of boots did they have? They had rubber soles. Look at the German boots. That's manly. I mean, they were no soldiers. How in the world could they conquer Germany? I discovered very soon how generous they were, giving chocolate, of course, also chewing gum, which we liked in that time, and food. And that helped immediately to break that vicious circle of Nazi propaganda.
So the bombing of the cities that was supposed to instill terror instead built rage, and the distribution of food helped to dissipate it.
Yes, and I should add to that, very soon came perhaps the most important food package in my life, a care package. And we received quite a few of those care packages to really change our minds towards the Allies, and especially in that respect, to America. The Americans were never really hated as such. It is just that the Jews rule America. That's the way we were taught. And then, of course, the bombing didn't help either. But that dissipated because of food packages.
When did you begin to hear the truth about what had been going on during the war?
I came over in 49 to New York, at the city where many, many Jewish people lived. That's where first time heard of a concentration camp. I understood that the Jews were not tolerated. I understood that the Jews were put into camps, but that they would be annihilated. It slowly dawned on me that the big lie, which Dr. Goebbels fed us daily through his speeches, was just a big lie. I could probably say that I was, as a young boy, a kind of a militarist. I believed in the military power of a man. And that slowly dissipated while I was in New York. For instance, I never heard of the author Kafka while I was in Germany, because he was Jewish, of course. So one of the greatest German writing authors, Kafka, I would not even know. I slowly saw what was happening to me, that this was a 15 years of brainwashing.
You mentioned Goebbels, who was a master and an innovator in many ways of manipulating the mass media in all of its aspects.
That evil genius, Dr. Goebbels, who, as you know, was minister of propaganda in a dictatorship and a totalitarian state, propaganda becomes so essential that they even bring it up to a ministerial position. And the power this man had over the media, including radio, movies, well, all of the media, what we have, was so great that a vacuum existed after it was over.
As you read about the madrasas that teach young Islamic men how to hate the West, what do you suggest the West should do, given your experience?
The first thing is that we must understand their culture and then bring in a propaganda, yes, a propaganda, with native speakers who will be able to tell them about the truth which really we live by, an entree to our culture, but not go against their culture and say, you are evil.
And care packages?
That is the best way of bringing the people to understand that we are loving and caring people, which America is.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ottmar Rudolph is an emeritus professor of German and the humanities at Reed College in Portland, Oregon.
The mind of a young person, especially one confronting war, can be hard to fathom. On March 1st, just weeks before the bombing began in Baghdad, the organization called Chat the Planet and the New York-based community media arts center, DCTV, teamed up to film a dialogue between Iraqi teens and their American counterparts. The resulting program, Bridge to Baghdad, a Youth Conversation, is a mix of live discussion and pre-recorded interviews with an array of Iraqi youth, like Eminem aficionado Saif and heavy metal rocker Waleed. We see them going through their daily rounds, hanging out with friends, and experiencing a healthy dose of teenage angst. The dialogue covers not only typical teen topics like music and dating, but also the politics of war.
Will you like if I come with an army and force you to kick Bush off? Will you like this? This is up to us.
I actually agree it would be a good idea for them to come in and get rid of Bush, but...
If you missed the show, that's not surprising. Since the taping, its producers have struggled to find a major TV outlet that will air it. But finding a national broadcaster is just the latest of many challenges, says executive producer John Alpert. Getting around the Iraqi Ministry of Information was another problem, but ultimately, the Iraqi government did not choose the Iraqi students who were featured.
We found them ourselves. And when we went to do their little biographical portraits with our video cameras, we tried not to have the babysitters with us. If the babysitters were along, we kept them occupied. We have diversionary tactics. I don't know if I should reveal all my techniques here on the radio.
But now, give us a little taste.
We would keep the minders preoccupied, sitting on a couch someplace with some tasty sodas and candies while we went off with the kids and talked to them out of earshot and out of visibility.
And did anyone in the Iraqi government see your tape?
There were some people from the government who were there as the dialogue was being taped, and they saw us send these biographical portraits via satellite, but they couldn't alter the content. It was happening live, and there wasn't anything they could do about it.
And did you see steam coming out of their ears or fear in their eyes?
No, not particularly. They did not like the part where Waleed showed us his bathroom. They're not a very rich family, and the bathroom basically is a hole in the ground. I think they would have liked to have presented something with higher quality plumbing.
Well, you mentioned Waleed and you mentioned the bathroom, so let's play a clip from Bridge to Baghdad, and you'll hear what one peek into Iraqi family life sounds like.
This is my favorite place in the house, and it's called the bathroom. I used to write my lyrics in the bathroom. You know, it's inspired me to get a nasty words. And every time when I get in here, you know, my mother used to do this. Please shut the fuck up. Yeah, you know, I'm facing a hard life, but I can handle this.
Okay, that was Waleed. He was your big find, I believe. A very outspoken young man. Tell me about Waleed.
Waleed almost seems like he's an American suburban kid, disenchanted but trapped in an Iraqi body. He learned how to speak English by listening to heavy metal lyrics, so his vocabulary is a little bit twisted, and has a band called the Black Scorpions.
Maybe the worst band ever assembled. Just for grins, let's listen to a bit of Black Scorpion.
And we're gonna rock you out, and we're gonna rock every bone in your body, so stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Well, Bob, I kind of give that an 8. It has a very good dance beat.
It calls to mind Glenn Miller to me. So you had difficulty getting this on television, and one of the reasons cited by several of the cable channels and broadcast networks was that they were afraid that the Iraqi students would be mouthpieces for the Saddam Hussein regime.
Well, I don't know, Bob. I think that anybody who saw the tape didn't say that. Our biggest problem in getting this broadcast was the lockstep mentality of all the networks counting down to war. And once George Bush declared that there were 48 hours to the war, they didn't want to see anything else except generals analyzing the battlefield, aircraft carriers. They really weren't interested in seeing real Iraqi people.
All right. Well, fair enough. But you entered this as sort of a girl with a reputation, did you not? You had run into difficulties earlier in your career, in fact, during the first Gulf War, with the perception that you were somehow an apologist for the Iraqis. Do you want to briefly tell me how that came to pass?
I don't think that anybody ever thought I was an apologist to the Iraqis. I initially was hailed as a hero because I was the only reporter able to beat Iraqi censorship and to be able to show during the first Gulf War that the smart bombs weren't as smart as we were being told. Saddam Hussein also was telling the same fib. He was saying there was no civilian damage. You can bomb us and we can take it. It was a lie, and we proved it was a lie. I snuck those tapes out of the country in my sock, brought them to NBC. Tom Brokaw looked at this. This was supposed to be the lead story of NBC News. And 3 hours before the broadcast, not a journalist, but the head of NBC News, canceled the program and fired me. We took these tapes to CBS. The executive producer of the CBS Evening News looked at this and said, "This is amazing. People need to know about this. I will broadcast this tomorrow night on CBS. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, he got a phone call, and he was fired.
Let's get back to the dialogue in your documentary between Iraqi students and American students. In this clip, they talked about movies and politics.
I was wondering where you get your sources for American history.
We are too interested in American movies. I think it shows your normal life, ordinary life. Don't you think that it's a good source to know about you?
Movies often do not portray normal American life, to be honest with you.
What do you think about the proposed alternative to war, which is a strengthened inspection process?
We have a solution. Your government will acquit and give up because we don't have any biologic weapons and just turn the soldiers back home and have a rest and let the world be in peace.
How are things resolved within the government when there are differences of opinion?
Can we, change the subject a bit? Do you like sports, any of you? Do you do anything?
I go dancing a lot. It's great.
How frightened do you think the Iraqi students were of the consequences of what they may say to you and to the American public?
I thought that they showed some degree of courage because they knew that there would be sensitive questions asked. I thought that some of the answers were candid, and some of the answers like this one, any intelligent listener can read between the line and realize it's something they don't want to talk about.
I saw some of the conversation among the young people as, I would say, intermittently interesting, a little stilted, a little predictable, not entirely illuminating on a question-by-question basis. But in its entirety, it was a most affecting broadcast because it really enabled you to see these people as people.
I think that is the major point of what we were trying to do. And if you felt that way, I'm flattered, and I think we did our job. The only thing we failed to do was we failed to get it seen by as many people as should have seen it. And I don't know whether this was one of the reasons why we had difficulty getting this broadcast, but everybody who watched that tape changed their minds about how they felt about the Iraqis. We had kids on the panel who initially were pro-war, and we had one of these kids come into us after he had talked to the Iraqis, and he said, "I can't sleep. I wake up and I see their faces, and I can't sleep. We have to try to come up with a way of dealing with this situation besides bombing them." The kids who were against the war had actually been going out to some anti-war protests, and the Iraqis thanked them and said, "We really appreciate you supporting our government and supporting Saddam." And they said, "Wait, we don't support Saddam. we're against the war. And they became quite troubled. It really changed the minds of everybody who participated in the dialogue.
Gradually, you are getting it on television, at least in bits and pieces. You've been on Good Morning America and MTV. You've aired on public television in New York. Are there any prospects for this as the war proceeds to get a wider audience?
A lot of the networks are now saying that the events of the war have passed this story by and the bombs are falling and it's too late. But I don't think it's ever too late to really see the people on the other side of the conflict and to get to know them. If you forget about the people, if they're dehumanized and all you see are the flags waving as the missiles take off from the aircraft carrier and the big maps and the generals talking about it, that's not the complete picture, and that's a dangerous situation.
Let's just for a moment visit another one of the Iraqi students. His name is Saif, and he's from a fairly well-to-do family, and he himself has a car.
I bought this car from my own money. This is one of my favorite music shop. This is شوف الكاسيت مال Eminem. I like Eminem. This is his album, his new album. I like it very much. I'm so shady.
Well, he is not, in fact, slim. He's a kind of heavy-set young man and very, very charming and very sweet. Have you been in touch with him and the other students since the war began?
Yeah, we managed to get a hold of Saif the day after the bombs started to fall. He was really excited to talk to us, but he started to cry. And he said, I'm scared. I'm scared. I'm so scared. He's quite shaken. Waleed, the heavy metal rocker, I mean, sort of is pretending like, give me a cruise missile, I'll eat it for breakfast. Nothing's going to bother me. And we talked to one other person, Heba. She said that nothing has happened to her neighborhood. The rest of the kids, we don't know what happened to them. A lot of people, just before the bombing started, tried to get out of Baghdad, and maybe they succeeded.
Well, John Alpert, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
John Alpert is the director of the Community Media Arts Center, DCTV, in New York, and executive producer of Bridge to Baghdad, a youth conversation. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Megan Ryan with Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Brian Tilley. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bydale Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.